welcome to The Next Page, the podcast of the UN Library and Archives dedicated to advancing the conversation on multilateralism. I'm Amy Smith, and today we're going to be talking about history and policymaking with our two distinguished guests, Davide Rodogno and Caroline Biltoff. So Davide is Professor of International History and Politics and head of the Interdisciplinary Master's Program at the Graduate Institute in Geneva. He specializes in researching international organizations and transnational networks and movements since the 19th century. And Caroline Biltoft is Associate Professor of International History and Politics, also at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies. Her work fuses the tools of world history, intellectual history and cultural studies, and critical theory. So welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here. You recently gave an introductory webinar for students at the Graduate Institute on whether historians would make good policymakers. And I wanted to invite you to turn this conversation around a bit and for you to talk on the next page about why history matters for policymaking. So quite often, when things are not going very well, we hear statements like, it's history repeating itself and we should learn from history. But what exactly do we mean? What does knowledge of the past offer for the present? And of all the different fields of knowledge that we draw on for policymaking, economics and statistics and modeling and the social sciences and increasingly behavioral science, why does history rarely feature if we really think it's so important to learn from the so-called lessons of history? So to start, what is history in your opinion? And would you each like to highlight perhaps a reason why history has value for policymaking?
Davide, you want to go first?
Okay. History is a wonderful discipline that has something which is very special and unique, is that nobody owns it, right? And so it's a bien commun, it's something that all of us, it's one of those commons. And so in so many ways, there is no way I can be right and you can be wrong. And this is one of the reasons why in so many places around the world, in all continents actually, it's not a fact of the West or the East or the North, there are local historians, people that know very well the history of a baobab or the history of a village or the history of something else. So there is always somebody who is a historian of something. And history has to do with the ways in which we in the present, whoever we is or are, understand, make sense of the past and project this past into the future. And history is also extremely simple because if it works on two axes, time and space, or times and spaces, and we can multiply. And of course, the appreciation of time and space that I have is different from yours, is different from Caroline's, and so on and so forth. So there is not a single definition of what history is, and there is not the right way of writing history, teaching history, etc. And so this degree of subjectivity, which is at times difficult to digest, is also one of the greatest strengths, because the way we connect things and interpret the exegesis, to use a very boring academic term, the interpretation of facts, depends on us. And the way I appreciate time and space and make sense of event, putting things together, is quite unique. And this is why I love history.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe what's beautiful about history also explains why it's left out in efforts to forecast, to decide, to define, to move and act in the world. It shouldn't be, first of all. But I think what a genuine kind of deep and careful study of the past reveals is that, for one thing, there are always more variables at work in any given context of decision-making than we take into account immediately. And it is also true that certain kinds or varieties of policymaking can't possibly take the full range of context into account, the weather in a day, the distribution of resources, the distribution of power. You know, there are so many layers at which things that affect us and our decision-making that we know of and things beyond our immediate field of knowledge, right? So I think because the past holds still for the historian, we can excavate the dimensions of the world at work in a given decision-making context in a way that you just simply cannot do in the immediacy of the present, right? However, I think that what Davide and I try to do is help future policymakers understand that that exercise, that discipline of historicity actually is eminently useful for decision-making, specifically because it attunes you to the sheer complexity of the world that's at work, and also the exercise of trying to account for things that aren't immediately relevant, right? There's so much policy discourse about trying to be practical and relevant, but actually the terms of relevancy are very diverse, right? And they may not be what you think they are. And so I think that's one of the kind of lessons of history, is that there are more variables at work in a given situation and context that you know. And even if a specific body of historical knowledge, you don't see it as directly relevant to giving you lessons, like the practice of training yourself on historical situations is eminently relevant to learning how to make wise, sound, and fulsome, right? Kind of a fulsome approach to decision making that's non-reductive in the present. So I think it's, for me, that's why history really, really continues to be important and matter, simply because of this way we have of observing in a kind of laboratory-like environment of the past, right? With all the variables that are at play that we can't see in the present, right? For a variety of reasons, which we can go into later maybe, but that would be my snippet.
Thank you. So in this way of observing and in uncovering this complexity, what would you highlight as some of the tools and methods and capacities that we need to develop?
Well, first of all, in your toolbox, and this is what is very humbling but very, very useful, is very often, since you are just like a pathologist, you know, it's a post-mortem exercise because the past stands still, so contrary to the present. And you already know that you have to leave aside so many things, just like Karen said a second ago. You learn that you have to be extremely modest, and what you're facing is extremely difficult, and the layers are so many, and so many of them are hidden, concealed, and you know or you suspect they exist, but you are not even able to make sense of of them. So this exercise in modesty is the first thing that comes to my mind. The second is the awareness of your subjectivity, which in a way invites you to consider all other stakeholders and say, okay, if I do have my perspective, whatever it is, maybe you will have a different perspective. And so this exercise in understanding who are your interlocutors, which is particularly important in the context of international negotiations and many other contexts that are, you know, the kind of history that we study, at least at the Institute, etc., is also extremely important and comes to mind as something that you will never forget. So you are not unique, but you are specific. And this entails that all the others are not unique, but they have their own specificities. And so this is also a kind of awareness that I think is very, very important, because acknowledging that there are multiple perspectives participates in this effort in modesty that you have to have, and this effort to understand where the others are coming from and where is that they want to go. And of course, this is extremely valuable when you're studying events that occurred in the past. But this might be, and this probably goes into the next questions that you will be asking us, this should be extremely relevant for policymakers that are facing the here and now, an issue that is taking place. It is the opposite of a postmortem, because the patient is alive and kicking, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point about humility. And I think intellectual humility that the historian needs is connected also to this... to the suspension of juridical judgment. I think that it is incredibly important for a historian, even if they have moral commitments, to not go to the past to judge someone as being right or wrong, right? But to really have the patience and, the respect for uncertainty to show the mechanics of a phenomena and to reveal the workings of a phenomena without moral judgment, not because we have no moral judgment to make, but because, like a stereotype, a moral position that you take from the outset will always blind you to some dimension or variable or source of ambiguity that actually is really important for understanding how things went, right? So obviously, if you're dealing with something egregious, like a genocide or a war or, you know, something that we consider egregious, you still have to go to the past with an effort to understand it rather than just pile on information about judging the actors as evil, right? So I think this, and that is also why it's important for the moment, like if the past, it's a kind of juridical lens, in the present, you need policymakers to not give in to stereotypes and shorthand, right? You need them to actually allow every person they interact with to remain a mystery to some degree, you know, to give them also the opportunity to observe change or the possibility for dynamic change, right? To not come in with too many presuppositions as a way of having a more open-ended orientation to knowledge, right? Then, and you know, in my previous work, my whole kind of intellectual paradigm is that there is a very tight relationship between fascism and the desire for absolute certainty. And so the anti-fascist mentality, which is, I think, also the best historical research, is one that kind of holds, and that's connected to Davide's point about humility, which is like the quest for certainty in and of itself will make you shut down so many nuances and ambiguities and possibilities, right? And so to hold open this kind of, let's call it a democratic ethos of patience, tolerance, objectivity, which we know is never possible, but is still something we hold as a virtue, right? Which is we try to look with as much care and concern into every nuance that comes across our field of vision. So I think the historian's tools of humility and of curiosity and patience in the face of complexity, and then just careful reading, you know, like, again, non-stereotyped reading. One exercise I like to give my students is quotations without the author, and they have to respond to the quotations just on the content. And then you tell them, well, that thing you loved, actually, Hitler said it, and that thing you hated, actually, it was Gandhi. And to try to dislodge them from their moral suppositions, to take content on its own terms, right? And to engage with the words, with the text, with the, and then you build in context, right? So once you engage with the meaning function, then you have to reinvest it in time and space and understand the conditions under which that statement was produced in order to get another layer of its meaning. So again, this is just an orientation towards learning and knowledge, whose goal isn't certainty, but meaning, right? The revelation of meaning. And that's just a different orientation than many social scientists have, which is to produce certainty, actionable forecasts, you know. So at least I don't, as a historian, that's not what I do, right? I don't produce certitudes.
Me neither.
Yeah. So it's about interpretation and revelation and meaning making above all, I think.
That's a very good description of this, developing this non-judgmental observation of things. So Davide, what happens when we forget history? Could you give us an example?
Forgetting history is extremely necessary. I think it was Todorov, somebody else from the social sciences actually, that said once that we should pay way more attention to oblivion, which is actually what all humans do every day of their lives. So we forget things, and forgetting is extremely important. Imagine for a second if you cannot forget pain. Life would become unbearable, impossible. So forgetting is one of these fundamental human functions. Then we have to distinguish in the political realm why forgetting becomes indispensable. And this is a political weapon, because forgetting becomes extremely useful to draw or design or write down history for political purposes. And this mixture of what is in and left out, hence forgotten, becomes extremely important to build a narrative of certainties and certitudes, exactly what Caroline was saying a second ago. And so this act of forgetting might be deliberate and needs to be studied. And so working on silences, for instance, is extremely important for historians, right? There are many of my colleagues that do it beautifully, and that's a great way of learning about the past and things that we've forgotten, that are not studied anymore or not highlighted anymore for a number of reasons. And then there is, you know, everything that has to do with physiological, I would say, biological aspects of our lives, where, you know, forgetting is a fact or is one of the features of us humans, and we forget. So forgetting, in my view, has exactly the same importance as remembering. You remember, you forget. So history is not just about memory. And, you know, memory studies are very, very important, and they have a very conspicuous place in what we do, in what we teach. And we never pay as much attention to forgetting. And I think rebalancing these two things is important.
Well, we've talked quite a bit about history. How about a little bit more about historians? Blondine, the chief of the institutional memory section here, mentioned to me the French historian Patrick Boucheron, and who describes historians as being specialists of change. Do you agree with that?
I think continuity and change, right? Like, I think it matters actually to mark what remains constant and what changes. So I think it's the dynamic between the two. But indeed, I think why that's important is because anytime we have a desire to simplify the past, you have the two modalities, which is revolutionary, forget everything. So let's say the Cultural Revolution in China, where they go through and scratch off the poetic inscriptions of the old world in order to make space for absolute memoryless novelty. And then you have the other conservative impulse of tying the past to a certain imagined that never was, right? But some imagined ancient eternity, gender, race, tribe, religion, all these things that are transtemporal constants are supposed to be transtemporal constants. And I think the historian's role is to look at why human beings mobilize discourses of change and continuity when they do for specific reasons, right? Why does the eternity of a seamless, ancient, supposed golden age have, you know, traction in a specific moment? Or why does the discourse of absolute radical disruption and revolution gain traction in a specific moment? So this is like the time magic that historians can pay attention to. Why do human beings use temporal metaphors to discuss how they want to design the world in a specific moment of time? So that would be more my take, actually, is that we use discourse of time to political ends. And then it's connected also to Davide's point about we remember and we forget according to the politics of a moment. And so the historian's job is to be a keeper of those manipulations of time and temporality so that we can observe the work that they do in the world, I think.
Fascinating. In the narratives that we create then about the past, what role do historians play? And what are some signs that would indicate that we might need to revisit our understanding of what happened in the past? So how do you see when you want to highlight those manipulations? And how do we go about that?
You know, there's a term that in many languages, for sure in English and in French, has a very negative meaning, which is revisionist. But if we do our job seriously, we are all revisionists. We revision the past. We look at the past differently. And many of our colleagues wrote history books on the League of Nations in the 30s, in the 40s, and, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago. And they look at it every time afresh. So they revision, they correct, they change, and we are not here to write Bibles. The purpose of the monograph of the historian is to die young, right? You can write an excellent history book, but if what you say is not corrected over time, there is something wrong with your raw work, or there is a process of forgetting that is happening that deserves to be studied. So the way we interpret the past is also, and systematically, depending on the times that we are living. And so the same object, the same institution, the same topic is appreciated, studied, examined with a different pair of eyes and the eyes of each historian. So we go back to what we were saying, you know, and we are here today in the Palais des Nations, recording this podcast, and the topic of the failure and the success of the League of Nations, how many times we've been exposed to that, and how many generations of historians have provided completely different answers to the same question. And so it is, I would say, really our awareness that the very nature of our work is ephemeral, right? is there to stay for quite some time and is there to be discussed, confronted, corrected, as I said before, by a new generation of historians, and they will look at things differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think in addition to that, like I often tell my students that at some point, a secondary source becomes a primary source. So if you look at Toynbee, you're not looking at Toynbee to get an accurate description of the history he's telling. Again, you're looking at his view of history and what it means about his moment. So I think that's the ultimate goal, is that we become enshrined in history itself because we are born. Like, that's the task of the historian, is to know that they too will pass, right? They do their most ethical best to sort of reframe or to revisit episodes in the past with an eye towards what matters to us now. And that doesn't mean that we're not moving towards some kind of ethics of truth-telling, but we are creatures of context. Like, we absolutely cannot escape our time-space limitations. And so at some point, our take on history will be historical. Our take on history will reveal as much or more about the moment in which we were writing as it does the subjects that we sought to unveil. And that doesn't mean we don't still, like, I return to Mark Bloch, right? I return to historians that were writing decades before me, and I still learn both. I learn something about the 30s and 40s through reading Mark Bloch, but I also still learn something about the King's Royal Touch in the medieval period. So it's not either or, it's just that many things have been written since. And part of what he reveals to us is what the work of a historian meant in his specific moment in time. Yeah, I think it's like that being comfortable with death and dying, like we are undertakers to a great degree, historians. We accept, I think, the social scientific neurosis, if we can call it that, is partly the eternity of truth that they're seeking. And we're much like, so we're not tech bros, right? We're not trying to live forever. Historians are more more comfortable, or I think they should be more comfortable with the fact that what actually unites human beings is that they die. And so we're all ephemeral, and that's the kind of bookends of our shared existence, right? Is the finality of it. So
and shared humanity, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, so death, it's like being cognizant of the role that death and disappearance plays in the human story and kind of being fine with that. That's all.
I think you're quite focused on death at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think it matters. I mean, that's what history is. You know, you can't go through an archive. You know, everybody you're looking at is gone. And so there's no way to truck in any other. You have to really do a lot of cognitive distancing to not wrestle with the fact that most of our characters have passed on. You know, that's the material we work with.
So the world has always been very complex, but today's world perhaps feels particularly so to us. And everything happens so fast, or seems to. And no doubt our listeners have heard much about the world being VUCA, you know, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. There's also a shift to talking now about the world as being banny, brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible. How can historical approaches help us to think differently and perhaps even shift paradigms? I think you've already touched quite a bit on this, but...
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's good that, like, I think when narratives are too simplistic, that's problematic. So I think that anxiety of the rapid heterogeneous world. I don't think the answer is giving people simpler narratives. I think it's teaching them so people need compasses and not maps. And I do think one of the solutions that people are getting out of touch with is classical education for everyone, where you read difficult texts, Toni Morrison and Shakespeare, like the diversity of perspectives and readings, and you teach people how to discern meaning again, rather than just make assertions or quips or extract buzzwords, right? So I think this, the work of actually classical university education, but also not just university education, like reading not just for the tests, reading not just for the results, right? Like training minds again, I think actually is one of the ways to re-anchor people in the work of interpretation. So you give them a rooted of sense-making, because what we are doing is we're defunding the humanities precisely when we need those humanistic principles to be able to make sense of the rapid information flux of the world. So I think that would be my answer, is that people need rigorous classical educations. They need to learn languages. They need to read novels. They need to look at primary source documents. And they need science and math, like just educational fundamentals across the board. I think would go a long way to helping counteract this kind of AI Instagram approach to reality that we have right now.
Can I go back to the terms that you mentioned
Please
before?
Do.
VUCA and BANI. So volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. That's VUCA, V-U-C-A, right? But it's precisely what we are supposed to explain and interpret, especially in contexts like ours, which are particularly, oh, we've got the impression that they are more volatile. But I'm pretty sure that if you asked in 1911 how a contemporary perceived her world, she would have told you that her world was very volatile, complex, ambiguous, and uncertain. So I'm just wondering the extent to which some of these terms are just universal and correspond to feelings or perceptions that each contemporary has in her own epoch. The second one is way more problematic to me. There is a term that I really love, which is nonlinear. Because we historians, so BANI, was brittle, anxious, nonlinear, incomprehensible, right? Nonlinear is the most interesting term of the four. Nonlinear is exactly what we have to teach, because otherwise we end up being simplistic. Linear is the kind of Whiggish history that we don't want to teach. You know, so we go from A to B, where B will be better than A. So the sense of, you know, ineluctable kind of progress, etc. So I would love to have more nonlinear present in what we do and skip. And being simple is not being simplistic. The two things are completely different. We need to be simple as historian, to be accessible. This is a term in French that Brodel used an awful lot, and he was damn right, I think. So we owe it to our readers to stay away from jargon and to be, you know, to stay away from oversimplification of sorts. But this doesn't mean to become linear. We have to cherish the non-linearity of the things that we tell, which is absolutely in contrast with incomprehensible. We have to be comprehensible. Brittle and anxious, we overuse these terms. We should stay away from both of them. Anxiety is a term that, for some reasons, has entered the vocabulary used by historians, and I think that very often it's not used in the right way. And many, many historians that abuse and refer an awful lot to anxiety of this, anxiety of that, and precisely they don't even make an effort to share with me, the reader, what is the meaning of anxiety, and anxiety might reveal itself very differently according to the place where you live, the community you belong to, the culture that you have. So very often I've got the impression that this is a very, you know, a term located somewhere in the West that is exported apropos everywhere else. And I'm not persuaded that this, of all these terms, this one makes any sense to me. So I would critically engage with each of the word of the eight terms that you shared with us very carefully and take away bits and pieces of them, trying to reinterpret them to what is important to me.
Absolutely. So more on decision-making and policy and the roles of historians. Why does history matter?
Yeah, history matters simply because of context. I think context always matters. But again, I think that for me, the big reason why history matters is the interpretive mechanism that historians give. So it is learning how to interpret the context in which things take place, to understand that we ourselves are embedded in context that we have to understand fully before acting, that things do evolve over time, but not in a straight line, right? So having all this kind of deep historical training, I think, is eminently useful for wise and sound policy. My least favorite cliche about the past is the past repeats itself, because it doesn't. We see echoes and resonances of similar patterns, but we don't see replication. Nothing is ever exactly the same. The one I love is the past is a foreign country, because I think as a traveler, you have to be so humble and so careful about navigating a context that you don't understand initially. Maybe there are linguistic barriers. Every past epoch is in some sense a deeply foreign environment because it isn't ours. So even if we recognize elements, just straining your eyes and your ears carefully to try to understand something that isn't eminently readable to you is an excellent exercise, right, for toleration, for care, for, yeah, again, for patience. And so I think analyzing the past teaches you to have that same kind of distanciation in the present and to know, actually, that the work of every environment is for you to listen really carefully and for a long time before you ever make judgments. And I get that the temporal immediacy of policymaking doesn't always allow for that. But even if you've been trained in that way, you carry that muscle of sense making and interpretation with you into policymaking context. I think it's exceedingly important just as an exercise.
If I may add something on this, first of all, I totally agree with Caroline. But for me, to use two images, history offers to policymakers depth. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's like moving from two dimensions to three dimensions. So if you want to be more accurate as a policymaker, you desperately need this third dimension. You will get it if you have a good knowledge of history. Then you can claim that history repeats itself. Then you can be political. I do not have a moralistic view on history. I know perfectly well that history is used and abused for political reasons. But even those that want to use history or abuse history have to know it, and they will be better policymakers. I might disagree with their policymaking, but I will acknowledge that they did a good job, and they did a good job because they have this depth and they use the past exactly for political purposes. Whether I share them or I don't, it's exactly, you know, my job is not to judge, it's to understand. And I can see the difference when a policymaker or some political person has a knowledge of history or not. Because very often, to me, she or he sounds very, very flat. And when this flat is also very simplistic, and when it's very simplistic, it's full of certainties, fake certainties. For me, intellectually speaking, the person is disqualified, and you can really find problems that are related to the interpretation of those facts that lead to political decisions. So history matters and matters a lot.
So since it matters so much, how do we facilitate better exchange between historians and policymakers?
That's a hard question. I mean, the Graduate Institute is trying to do that all the time. Like, that's what international history and politics does. That's our mission. That's our mandate. That's why we're international history and politics now instead of just international history. But I mean, that question is a difficult one to answer because there's some degree that if you're doing your job right as a historian, your audience is small, right? Because people do want the buzzwords and the simplistic renderings of the world. So I do think that the role of universities and training future policymakers, again, has to be respected. The thing isn't about whipping up a big audience. It's about training minds that go into the world with excellent training. And so I still think of myself not as a public intellectual. I think of myself as a teacher. And the intellectual work I do, I necessarily have a pretty small audience because I am meticulous and painstaking and careful. And I didn't write a book you can summarize. I think of that part of the work as feeding my intellectual life, as something we're putting in the world for posterity, as a placeholder for posterity of what rigorous research is. But I think universities need to take the depth aspect of training very seriously and not kind of give over to this neoliberal buzzword phenomenon and really train minds. And it is practical. It is imminently practical. And one thing we have to do is push back against the discourse that says the humanities aren't practical. Like, the humanities are imminently practical in the world if you want to have sound, wise, stable, sane, you know, all the reasons. So I think this is kind of my hobby horse these days. Like, it's really standing for the importance of humanistic inquiry into practical policymaking circles. And that happens in universities. So we need universities, we need libraries, we need archival funding, we need to make sure that we are really standing on the tenets of an open society. And that is actually education.
I also think that our format is not necessarily a TV format or an Instagram format where, you know, it's thumbs up or down. I believe we scholars and historians in particular, we have to make an effort to reach out and there again to be very, very simple. I can give you an example. A few days ago, I attended and moderated an event and somebody from the public, which was a public of non-specialists, it was a public event, somebody asked a question on intersectionality. And the person was booed by the audience because this was a jargonic term that people didn't understand, etc. My first reaction was to say, okay, you're right. Maybe we, since the term comes from us scholars, maybe the term is complex to digest. It's a difficult term. It's a very long word, etc. And we don't understand, or you don't understand, what is the meaning of this. But then I think it's our role as scholars to explain in simple, plain terms what this is about so that we can keep the conversation going. And this is our responsibility. This is where we need to find a way to stay away from jargon and explain in a different, simple way something that is extremely clear for us and superficial, because a single term encompasses an awful lot of things, which is great for us, but we have to make an effort because what is very efficient for us might be hard to understand for other people. And this is something that we have not been doing for so long. And we historians, we made a mistake at some point. I don't know when, I suspect in the 1980s, 90s, mimicking the language of social sciences, when in fact we should have treasured and cherished the way we speak, which is precisely very, very simple. And I'm not saying that these words are not necessary. They are super necessary and very important because you will make an economy of sentences if you can be efficient. But when you want to reach out, you really have to make an effort. If we don't, we scholars, we historians, we will be accused, as it was happening that night, of living in our ivory tower, right? And becoming inaccessible or living in a bubble and living comfortably in this bubble, unable to share our knowledge. If we are unable to share our knowledge, then the purpose of what we do becomes meaningless. So on the one hand, I hear, and it's very important what Caroline is telling about training. This is our pedagogical mission, is really about that. And I do believe that humanities are eminently practical. And this is where I do connect them with policymaking. But at the same time, there is a second role that we have to have, which is spreading our knowledge beyond academia and being able to communicate in very simple, plain terms with a wider audience, especially with those who do not share our ideas.
And I think, too, maybe it's a division of labor, because I have a mixed feeling on this, right? Because on the one hand, I think of, if you take Graham Greene and Nabokov in terms of novels, I would rather read a Nabokov any day of the week than a Graham Greene. And Graham Greene gives that simple message that a more wide audience could understand eminently. Nabokov is strenuous. He asks something of you. And so I think it's this line of balance because, you know, as a university professor, I do believe in the ivory tower only to the extent of, I think people need time to study difficult things and learn multiple languages and learn to read texts that are difficult and strenuous, not as a form of elitism, the opposite of elitism, as a form of sense-making. So we do have to have some historians that are willing to do public outreach, right? And then I do think we still need to write complex, strenuous books, too, that fill libraries, just because of the record-keeping function of, like, we want Nabokovs. We want to live in a world that's still producing difficult, strenuous, challenging texts. And sure, that's not going to be for everyone, but we don't want that to disappear. And if we don't invest in the infrastructure of intellection, which is archives, libraries, and training, there's nothing to say to the public. Right. So I think we have to hold that, you know, we have that balance of being able absolutely before a public audience to not speak in professional jargon. But the task of intellection as an enterprise, I think it's rapidly disappearing from Earth if we're not careful. Like, if you've seen Elon Musk that thinks his AI Grok can write poetry, and it's the worst end rhyme poetry that you can possibly imagine. And then people are like, wow, this is the most beautiful poetry. Well, I mean, if you have no link that connects you to a deeper tradition of the Arabic language, you know, all the poets, the Sufic poetry of Rome, like if you don't have an anchor in the beauty that's been produced on earth, it's so easy to erase it because it's not practical. So somebody needs to keep a candle burning for difficulty, like erudite, rigorous, difficult interpretation. And so like that's what worries me about the message of absolutely, we have to be able to translate. But on the other hand, we also have to fight for the right that it is important and powerful to read strenuous, difficult, multifaceted texts. So I think that's the kind of the line that we have to walk today between practicality and not. And so like we could teach a whole course on actually why, yeah, again, why the Iliad and the Odyssey might matter for contemporary policymakers. There are probably a million reasons why that would be true. So I think someone has to fight for that.
Thank you, Carolyn. I was going to ask
you about... I'm so passionate about that. I'm sorry.
Yes, I was going to ask you about erudition as a form of activism. You'd spoken elsewhere about that, and that's wonderful.
No, I think it is true. Like, as someone, and not to bring too much personal story, but like, growing up in an impoverished socioeconomic class in rural Nebraska, the Nebraska Public Library was a window to the universe for me, right? And so the binary that we have to get rid of is like poor kids can only do practical things. I think the message that we have to make is that this access to forms of reading, like I read Nabokov scrubbing floors in a truck stop as a waitress, right? And that like the juxtaposition of deeply practical work and then this illumination that ideas and texts can bring to your life, even if you end up as a doctor or a lawyer or a mechanic, it's not a juxtaposition. It's not opposed to also enriching your inner universe with ideas and texts and the ability to speak languages. And so for me, erudition as activism means that every kid on earth deserves to acquire these tools and have access to books in a way that will open their universe rather than keep it small. I really believe in an open, accessible public education where we still buy physical books, not just ebooks, where we give kids of all backgrounds, races, and ability levels the ability to have access to wide and diverse forms of knowledge. So they can be whole minds, not just cogs in a machine. We want people to be whole and not just specialized. So for me, it's my social justice. It's my social justice trope that I stand on, which is like elitism is for everyone, basically.
Yes to that. Both of you do research on international organizations, and the Secretary General is introducing a shift in the way we work to the UN 2.0. And this year, member states will also be discussing a series of policy briefs and negotiating a pact for the summit of the future. Thinking about reform of the UN, do you think history has been taken enough into account? And what, if anything, do you think is missing?
That's you, man.
Yes.
That's a difficult one. I will give you two answers. The first has to take into account what is that the Secretary General can and cannot do. So this is my answer as a historian, to try and understand why he says what he says. And I believe that he's extremely aware of the need for change of this particular institution that we are sitting in today. So there is this aspect. And of course, he has to forget a number of things and encompass other things in what he thinks has to be the construction of the engine that will allow the organization to move on and probably turn this page and open a brand new chapter of its history. Now, if we look at history in a different way, I could tell you that, of course, history is not taken into consideration because probably if we were to take history very seriously, this institution as it is designed should disappear. And that's a hard, you know, truth or a hard thing to say, especially here. But it's not because I don't like the institution, but simply because the blueprint of the institution goes back to a time that is not just in harmony with the times we're living in today. And so it is as if we were driving a machine of the 1940s in 2024. And probably today we have drones, we have electric cars, etc., etc. And we will have very old car with very old brakes and with a very rusty kind of engine. And so it's the entire blueprint of the institution that should be changed, which is something that has already happened in the past. Of course, the political willingness or determination to do this is absolutely absent at the moment. I don't see it. Maybe other people in other places will see it. From this particular vantage point, which is Geneva and the Palais des Nations, I don't see it. Or the Graduate Institute, I don't see it. And so in this respect, history is not taken seriously, because we could have several examples of institutions that died and for some reasons resurrected, and others that died and were replaced or not replaced at all. So these options should be considered. If I were the Secretary General, I would not consider them for obvious reasons. But since I'm, you know, just a historian, I can afford thinking of other options.
I think I have. I mean, my take on that as a historian of the League of Nations, right, was an organization that died and became something else, kind of this phoenix thing. The role of history in the reform of the UN for me, because I never have actual policy suggestions, would simply be an educational suggestion, which is to know what role deeply international organizations play in the world, and then to update the software to know what the world that we're in actually looks like. So it would be seen where what the kind of, from what I understand about how international organizations work, they have a hegemonic role, which is they produce narratives and stories really more to hold the world together in its current manifestation and to make changes on the margins, like where it's possible to make changes on the margins. So I think a reform that took history into account would be a deep study of the conditions under which the organization was born and what has changed since then, what literal material phenomena have changed, shifted, been altered. So that the storytelling function of these international organizations, which is one of the most important things that they do, is they provide narratives for the world. So then it would be, you're never going to get the story 100% right, but you can at least be cognizant of that storytelling function that the organization serves and try to, yeah, update the software, right? It would be to take the past into account so you know where we've been, so you know we're not, so you know where we are. Yeah, I think that would be my, you know, that's why history can matter for institutional reform.
Thank you so much. You certainly brought depth and context to this conversation. I was wondering if we could perhaps leave with a couple of book suggestions. Anything that you've been reading recently that you would like to talk about?
A reading list, sure, anytime. So Sidiya Hartman's Beautiful Lives Wayward Experiments, I hope I got that title right. That's a very beautiful book I read recently. In novels, does that count? Dennis Johnson. These days, he has this little novella, Train Dream. So if you're out there and you want a new novel to read, I think Dennis Johnson is one of the... Murakami has a new one coming out. Those are novels. But in terms of history, I think, yeah, Sidiya Hartman, I've been reading a lot of lately, and I think she's just really a brilliant mind, has a brilliant way of looking at sources. Old books, Deep History in the Brain, Daniel Lord-Small, he looks at the relationship between neuroscience and history. It's very interesting.
That's a new take.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. There's a lot of good stuff out there.
So I had at least three titles of novels that I read during the Christmas break, two in French and one in English. But I will not give you those titles. But this morning there was a wonderful interview somewhere on the children of Garcia Marquez, and it was an interview on his novels by his family and relatives, etc. And I would like to go back to 100 Years of Solitude. I read it in Italian, 100 anni di solitudine, when I was a teenager, and probably it's one of the books that's stayed with me the most, and I'm very, very close to many of the stories that are in this book. Many of them are related really to uncertainty. And Love at the Time of Cholera, it's another book by Garcia Marquez that I loved. And the short stories, of which there is one located here in Geneva, and it speaks about the waves of the lake. And it's a beautiful metaphor. So I would be really in favor of rereading or rediscovering Garcia Marquez. That's my suggestion.
And that's a great historian's text as well, because he's interested in time, right? Like fundamentally, so.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, fabulous. We've closed the circle. What a wonderful way to end. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.